Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Jordan Jarrett Bryan of Channel 4 News, and Seb Stafford Bloor of Tifo Football. The Pozzo family, who run Watford as a personal fiefdom, are reported to be seeking their third manager of the season. Claudio Ranieri will be sacked as soon as his replacement has been secured. He lasted 14 matches and will leave with relegation looking likely. This is what happens when a club ignores the convention of continuity. The question is, have the Pozzos written off relegation as a business expense? Because of parachute payments, it's likely that clubs like Watford, and Norwich for that matter, will bounce straight back. Just look at Fulham running away with the championship. So Jordan, simple question. Is the Premier League in danger of becoming a bit of a closed shop?
Yes, it is. I think it actually, to some degree, already is a closed shop. I was thinking over the weekend after the Watford defeat that there needs to be some kind of like Premier League B League where you'd have the likes of Fulham, West Brom, Watford, Norwich in it, who can't make their minds up about what league they really want to be in. Not quite good enough for the Premier League, but obviously, it's way too good for the championship. And I think that we've known with Watford as an example for a while that the business model for them works. You know, they don't mind going down as long as they know they can get the finances that come with going back up again. I tend to think about the fans in this example and what it must be like to be a Watford or a West Brom or a Norwich fan. And I think I saw some banners or some paper signs at the Watford game where they were calling for Ranieri to go. And I thought to myself, so are even now the Watford fans almost indoctrinated in this idea and acceptance that this is what we do now, you know, a handful or two of bad games and we sack the manager. That's what we do now, right? And I think it's one thing if that's the owner's model, but even if the supporters themselves are now buying into that, that for me is a lot more concerning because it says to me now that you've lost all sense of what it is you're supporting your football team for. Okay, nobody wants to get battered every single weekend. I understand that. But I think there's a problem now the Premier League have created whereby the riches of being in the Premier League are so, so high. It seems to be Premier League or nothing. And I remember hearing a Sunderland fan on the radio about 5-6 years ago, maybe longer, and they were on the verge of going down themselves. And he said, everyone is trying to like work out examples or work out theories and give their opinions about how Sunderland can stay in the Premier League. But at the end of the day, football's football. If we go down, we go down. You know, we might come back up, we might not, but we still support our team. And this idea that it's Premier League or the world ends. No, I'm an Arsenal fan, so maybe I'm coming from a bit of a snobby, you know, snobby stance up here that if my club went down, it'd be the end of the world for me. But for teams that maybe aren't as big or used to be in the Premier League as mine are, I think they need to get their heads around the idea that you may go down. I think it's the actual, are you trying to stay in the Premier League, I think is the bigger concern. I think what's often the Watford fans is giving up the joy of wanting to be in the Premier League in favour of this quick turnaround of managers that may keep them in the Premier League.
Yeah, I thought it was ironic that the defeat by Norwich, which did for Ranieri, came on the fifth anniversary of Graham Taylor's death. Now, there was a manager who was fundamental to that club's development. He understood the importance of community and continuity at that level. Is there a bit of a moral there, Seb?
Yeah, without question, Mike. So the Taylor comparison is perfect, really, because I think one of the problems at Watford is the manager now is an employee and solely an employee. When they make an appointment, it's not with that football word that gets tossed around a lot. It's not with a project in mind, is it? It's someone comes in, it's a different voice in the change room, different set of tactics, and that's it. They don't really have any control over the club's philosophical approach to recruitment. They don't have an effect on the kind of the internal workings of the departments within the club. It's just a person to sit in a chair. And that is the complete opposite of Graham Taylor. Actually, just a quick plug, because I, on a recent visit to Vicarage Road, I bought a copy of his autobiography, and he talks about his life at Watford. And I think one of the things that stuck with me after reading it was just how much he loved that period of time and just how invested in not just the performance of the team, but the whole thing. And you've mentioned community there and fans, and yes, that's very, very important, but also had a real bond with certain players, and you don't have that at Watford now. You don't have that. And I mean, I haven't been to Vicarage Road for a couple of years now, but I used to think about that anytime I go there and you see the statue of him outside the club shop.
Yeah, well, that was a club I grew up with as a kid, and it has changed fundamentally, and that's probably why I've become alienated from it, to be perfectly honest. That's an admission that probably won't go down as a surprise among some Watford fans, but I'm not going to really apologise for it. You know, when you look at the club at the moment, Jordan, there are unmistakable signs of tensions, aren't there? Especially in the dressing room. There was a moment during that game where Yao Pedro, very talented young kid, only 20 years old, absolutely called out Josh King, who's a senior pro. Now, you know, we've all been around long enough to know that's the sort of clash which probably gets amplified the moment they get back in the changing room at half time. Interesting that Ranieri, in what was probably his valedictory address, criticised so-called selfish players. But how can you have loyalty as players and staff if basically that's not reciprocated?
Well, you can't. You can't, Mike. I think asking that from any individual when you're not giving it out yourself, I think is a crazy one. I think the tensions that we're talking about amongst the players at Watford, I think, is born out of frustration that they're struggling at the bottom end of the table. But I think it's also a collection of just random players. Some are decent, some aren't, that don't really know why they're here, but it's a Premier League club and it's kind of near London, so it's not a bad gig. They're not really buying into any kind of long-term project of let's try and get Watford, you know, up, you know, maybe a cup run in the next couple of years, maybe European football. There's no real, the team are disjointed because they're all a bunch of random players, first of all, but they're also not buying into any one particular philosophy or project, as Seb mentions earlier on. So when you get that, I think you get a lot of clashes of personalities of, well, do you know what you're doing? I don't know what I'm doing. What are you doing? And why are we here? And we're going to play a game. And it just all feels a little bit all over the place. And I think that the clashes for me are no surprise. I think, again, going back to the Watford supporters, if I'm watching that, I don't know what I'm watching. I just don't know what I'm watching. I'm just seeing a collection of individuals with their own interests, not only on the field, but off the field as well. So it's those guys I feel sorry for the most. But the clashes that we saw over the weekend, they're not surprising to me, because I just think you've got a bunch of individual random players of differing levels from bought by different managers who don't quite know what they're doing, if that makes sense.
Can I introduce a word here, Mike, just because I think it's pertinent? Accountability. Right. If you, like Jordan's hitting the nail on the head there, because if you recruit across several different managerial eras, a word that flatters managerial appointments at Watford, you know, but obviously
they're called months.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. So if you do that, and also you've got a head coach who we know that Watford will happily sack someone after 10 games, where is the kind of overarching sense of responsibility? Because all the people that are actually, all the architects of the situation are the people not on television. They're not in the firing line. So what you have is players who, the worst thing you can ever give a professional footballer is an excuse. Worst thing, because like there's always the opportunity to pass responsibility somewhere else, because there's always it's a problem with the manager, it's a problem with my teammate, it's a problem with the crowd, they're not being supportive enough, it's a problem with the fixture list. Like this is what happens when you have a lack of clarity at a football club. You don't get the opportunity to point the finger at someone and ask them to take responsibility for what's going on. And this is Watford, and it isn't just Watford. There are a few clubs like this, there are quite a few clubs outside of the Premier League like this, and there are clubs all over Europe like this. But this is what you invite when you create a system which, when it goes well, you can act like the smartest person in the room. When it goes badly, there's no one around to talk about it. There's no one around to kind of to front up to television camera or to fans. And this is the result.
I totally agree with that. And just to build on that, I think there's an interesting comparison, but not with Everton. I think there's also a bunch of players there that have been bought by a series of managers over the last 5 or 6 years. But the difference, I would say, is there was an incident after the game where Bill Kenwright came out and addressed some of the fans. Now, Seb mentions the word accountability. Accountability is one of my favourite words in life. I don't think we have enough of it in society, in politics, in sport, in business. I just don't think we have enough of it, but it's one of my favourite words. I think he was taking accountability for probably stuff that isn't even on necessarily his responsibility. He has other people that, you know, run that club and work with him there. So what's happening at Everton, I don't want to move away from Watford here, but I just thought it was an interesting example there of someone who is taking accountability, even maybe when he shouldn't. Do you know what I mean? I don't think he's the majority shareholder there anymore. Whereas at Watford, I don't know who these people are. We know the names, but we don't really know these people. And they, as Seb says, they're not on TV. So they get to escape that scrutiny that I think they would get if they were being held more accountable.
There are some really good people in the background at Watford. Miguel Rios is one of the best scouts around, I feel. And, you look at their recruitment, okay, it's done in industrial capacities. 21 players they've had in since July. Samir, Hassan, KMB, they look decent.
Samir's a good player. Yeah. Samir's a good player. Yeah.
And they looked good January signings. But probably will that be enough? I doubt it. What do you think, Seb? They got a chance? I know we've written them off pretty much now, but have they got a chance?
They've got a chance by default, Mike, because, like you say, there are good people there. There are people at Watford who can spot a player, and there is a chance that they can bring in the right sort of head coach before the end of the season who would provide the jolt that their system depends on. And there's always a chance. And also because I think this is quite a poor Premier League at the sort of bottom five is quite weak. So you just have to be the least bad. It's like, you don't have to outrun the bear. You just have to outrun you. So it's kind of easy. But I don't know. But I think the virtue of scouting is something that has to be looked at in isolation. The ability to recruit players. Like there's no Michael Edwards without Jurgen Klopp, in a sense. Like Michael Edwards is a hugely talented guy, I understand that, but the virtue of Liverpool's system is the fact that everything complements everything else. The all these little sort of interdependencies matter. So you can have the smartest recruiting staff in the world, but if you don't have the person that can use what you've identified, what does it matter? So yeah, they can do, but then I think that that they have that opportunity describes a kind of a level of dysfunction at the bottom end of the table, really, rather than anything.
The reason why, just briefly as well, I think they have got a chance as well, is they have goals. They do have some scorers in that team. And I think unlike a Burnley, even Leeds to some degree, who are struggling to score goals, I think at the bottom end, it's more about, can you score goals? Top end, I think defence has been leagues. But I think to stay in the league, I think if you've got goal threats, I think you can score your way out of trouble, and they do have some of those in their team, to be fair to them.
Yeah, Watford have yet to keep a clean sheet, and they've got a key game coming up next on February the 5th, which is on BT Sport, at Burnley. Now, Jordan, you saw to your probably displeasure yesterday that Burnley were as obdurate as ever at Arsenal. A lot of familiar virtues in that performance, wasn't there?
There was, and I don't think we saw anything from Burnley that we didn't expect. They knew that Arsenal's home record is impressive. I know they got beat in the week in the cup there, but and to City in the last home game, so I've undone my own point there. But generally, their home record is really, really good. So they just thought, if we can get out of here a point, we know how to stifle Arsenal. They think they beat Arsenal, but they beat us last year at the Emirates, I think, if I'm not mistaken there. So they knew what the plan was. Everybody else knew what the plan was going to be, and they executed the plan to perfection. I think towards the end, they could have nicked it as well, as was the plan. The reason why I think Burnley are in trouble, and I have for a while now, is that I'm just not sure if the be solid, be hardworking, and we'll nick a goal, that runs out after a while. You can do that for 3, 4, maybe 5 years, but eventually, I think you have to evolve. Because I think the teams that are coming up, I think they're evolving. We've seen in the past few years, Wolves, Leeds, Villa's return. These teams have kind of come back into the Premier League and are adding more to the league than just we are hard to beat. And I think that is the concern. So while it, I think, was a very, very worthwhile point, they got at the Emirates yesterday, I fear that in the long term, that will not be enough to keep them in the Premier League.
Yeah, you know, resilience is a bit of a muscle memory, isn't it, that a team rarely loses. But the problem is that the team remains static, so therefore that acts against you in the long run. That's a big weakness for them, isn't it? Now, they're looking to strengthen at last, one would say, Seb. Aaron Ramsey? I just can't see him fitting in there.
No, and one of the reasons you can't is because, and I think this is one of the fundamental difficulties that Burnley experience, is it's really hard to recruit. It's really hard to get players to go to Burnley. Well, John's right in the sense that you need to evolve as a team. But it's very difficult to evolve when you're so associated with a single style, which I imagine for some players is very off-putting. So it's kind of a never-ending circle and a kind of chicken and egg situation. Can you recruit an Aaron Ramsey type to change the way you play? No, because the Aaron Ramsey type doesn't really believe that you want to evolve in the first place. So it's very difficult. I don't see it. I think Juventus to Burnley, it's kind of a strange one. I'm still staggered that Maxwell Cornet is playing for Burnley.
Same.
I find that very odd. I think he's so talented. He's such a good player. And it's a hell of a recruiting job by Sean Dyche and his staff. I don't know. And I think fundamentally there are players, and that's not a skirt around the issue. There are a lot of players that would look down on Burnley, think they're above it. And also, I suppose for someone like Dyche, the problem you have is when you make a lunge at a player like that, are you infecting your playing group with something you don't want, attributes which are undesirable? I think you might do, because we've talked about resiliency. Now, the one commodity you have to have if you're a football team like that is buy-in and commitment. And what you can't have is sort of players that come in, think, you know, are on a little bit more than everybody else and think they're above mucking in with the kind of the group effort. You can't have that. You can't have that. So I don't know what the answer is here. I agree with everything that we said. I just don't know what the route forward is. They need a centre forward. They need goals, clearly, because lost Chris Wood, and he wasn't scoring goals anyway. But it's a tricky one.
It's not as simple as machine gunning money at people, is it, Jordan? Because you think about it, okay, Chris Wood, Newcastle. It was interesting that Eddie Howe, after that win at Leeds, made a point of stressing the importance of recruitment, and he mentioned Wood and Trippier in that regard. You know, we're led to believe they'll be busy in the week that's left in the window. Up to 5 further players coming in again. It's not that simple, is it? You know, are players going to turn down Newcastle, Jordan?
Some will. I think it's about motive. I think it's about, you know, what's their reason for wanting to go there. I mean, I don't know if many players are going to be excited by the idea of a relegation battle with Newcastle United, and that's why I'm coming here. I'm coming for the fight. It's like, I don't see that. I think you're going to have to, and they probably know this, over inflate certain wage offers to get certain players there. And then you have that kind of whole situation whereby you've got players that are playing for you that don't really want to be there. They're there because you've doubled, tripled their wages. So I don't know if that is the answer as well. I mean, even loans, people are saying, oh, they should get loans in, but I always feel it's weird when you kind of get loans in when you're fighting relegation, because the person that comes in has no real reason to go that extra mile. Do you know what I mean? To keep you in the league. So I think you're better off just buying a player on a 2-3 year deal that at least he knows he's there for the next 2 or 3 years. So he doesn't want to be in the Championship. I think you get 10-20% more out of that player. Throwing 4 or 5 new players into that team, I don't think it's a great idea either. It's not the best team, but I wonder, with Newcastle not being cut adrift, if just 2 or 3 smart signings is better at this stage than just a wholesale, let's change half the team sort of situation. But I think they'll go down personally regardless, but I think it's giving themselves the best possible chance. the two signings they've made so far, I think, are sensible, if not overwhelming. If they continue on that trajectory of just really smart tweaks rather than wholesale changes now, I think they've got a better chance of staying in the Premier League.
If they do go down, Seb, what would the real damage be? Would it be reputational rather than financial? And, you know, does that point up the fact that the nature of the club's ownership puts them under the biggest pressure of all the clubs at the bottom?
I don't know. It's a little bit of a question without an answer, Mike, because they go down, they'd buy their way back up, and I'm sure they would bounce straight back into the Premier League. I mean, their kind of recruiting targets would probably have to change, but I see it only as sort of a delay in the inevitable. You have that much money. It's not that you can't fail. It's just that the boundaries which you occupy get narrower and narrower. So actually, with that in mind, I think the two signings they have made are quite sensible in a way, because I know Kieran Trippier has had a great career, but I don't think either he or Chris Wood would demand a move were they to drop into the Championship. I don't think they would see themselves as above that. So that's quite sensible. But no, if they went down, they'd spend a huge amount of money and they'd come straight back up. And they'd probably plunder a few Championship rivals along the way, I suspect. So, yeah, I'm not sure it makes a difference.
Yeah, Jordan, you follow the sort of political nuances of top-class sport. Newcastle, the squad are now in Saudi Arabia, warm weather training in Jeddah. Eddie Howe talks about this. Yeah, it's just for football reasons. Is it a bit more nuanced than that?
I always find it, and I know that you guys are politics guys as well, we know what's happening with the current government in this country at the moment. And I always find it interesting when, no one's asked this question as well, whenever you see the people around Boris Johnson being asked a question about Boris Johnson, no one's asked a question, do you feel a bit silly having to lie and defend what we all know is indefensible? Just be honest, do you just feel a little bit like, I know you've got to defend him, I know you've got to back him, and cool, we get it, we get the game. But be honest, you feel a bit silly, don't you? And I feel with Eddie Howe, it's a little bit similar. I'm a little bit like, you're not an idiot. You know what's going on here, but you're in a position where, listen, it's a job, you're paid very well. I don't have any problem with anybody getting paid. But when he comes out and says it's for footballing reasons, I just think to myself, you've got to say that. We get it. But come on, Eddie. We know what's going on here. And I think this whole warm weather training thing in Jeddah, wherever it is, we know what it is. And I don't know if we as the media or journalists can really, beyond kind of applying a consistent amount of pressure to kind of ask questions about what's happening behind the footballing element of this club, I don't know there's much more we can really do at the moment. I think we've got to be quite smart and pick our moments. I know there's a lot of investigations that are going on at the moment to look into what's really happening there. But I just think Eddie Howe's in a position whereby he's in an impossible position, because I'm still not convinced, even if they stay in the Premier League, that he's there next season. So never mind go down. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So there's a lot going on there at the moment, not only off the field, behind the scenes, but I think on the field as well. It feels a little bit of a mess. But to answer your question, I mean, I think we're all aware of the political angle of the takeover and what's happening there. But I think we've got to almost pick our moments as to when we go for the throat, if you like.
Yeah, there are moments where I absolutely yearn for the simplicity of the ownership structure at a club like Norwich. Now, well, you've just basically got Delia. You know, there's a club, another club that's got relegation built into the financial model. Two wins on the bounce now. Will it need a third? They've got Palace on the restart after the winter break to actually take them seriously.
No, I think I take them seriously now, because I think we've reached a stage where they're obviously not a hopeless case. And by the way, I want to recognise the work that Dean Smith has done, because think about the difficulty involved in that job. Like, first of all, you take over a group of players whose level of confidence has been shattered. Some of them have gone through it twice with bad Premier League campaigns. Also, a group of players who were serving under a very, very long-term manager, an unusually long-term manager in Daniel Farke. And Dean Smith has actually managed to get a reaction. That's very, very good coaching. But no, I go back to what we said earlier about Watford, is that this is not a strong Premier League in the sort of the bottom five places. Put two wins together and all of a sudden your reality starts to change. And you see players who've been punchlines, like Josh Sargent a little bit. I still think Josh Sargent's quite a limited player, but there's a contribution all of a sudden. And by way of just being competent, you can survive. So I think Palace, that's a very difficult game to come back to, because Palace will be reinforced by the AFCON players. Wolf Sahar will be back most likely. Che Kouyaté will be back. And those have been big misses, clearly. But I think we saw yesterday, you know, how good a player Michael Olise is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Eric Eze is getting fitter. Like, that's a talented player. That's a talented team now. Add in a Conor Gallagher type. Palace are not sort of... have kind of broken free of the identity which they've worn for a couple of years, which is that kind of limited lower half table. They can beat good sides, and Norwich are a few wins away from being a good side yet, but it's interesting, and it needed to be. I don't think it's a theme that we dealt with earlier. I don't think the Premier League benefits from hopeless cases. I don't think it looks very good. In Germany, there's a team, Greuther Fürth, who came up from the Zweite Bundesliga. And I don't think they waited until the end of November to get their first win of the season. And over time, and my German is kind of limited, so I wasn't really fully part of this conversation, but that sort of situation is involved in the kind of, oh, the Bundesliga isn't very good this season. It's missing the big clubs, the Schalkes, the HSVs, those kind of sides. And we get this little diddly club in recompense. And they started to win. They won over the weekend as well. And I think it's good for the league. I think it's good to see clubs move in and acquire some sea legs at that level. And that's kind of what Norwich are doing. They're away from competency, but it is... No, I haven't given up on them.
Yeah. Which clubs then could be drawn in, Jordan? You know, mentioned Leeds earlier on. They had their two wins on the bounce before they lost to Newcastle. I suppose when you look at it, they're missing Calvin Phillips and Patrick Bamford really badly, aren't they?
They really are. They really are. I mean, I was looking over the weekend at the table, and I think Leeds... I mean, I guess you kind of have to drag them in there to some degree, because I think Brentford are in that mix now as well, and they've played two more games than Leeds. So I guess by default, Leeds are, you know, candidates to be dragged into that bottom three. I think they'll just be okay. I think that bottom half is really bad. And I don't think you have to do a lot to... I think they've got enough to kind of avoid or to become the best of the worst, if you like. But they need to score some goals. I don't quite know what's happened to Bamford. Is it an ongoing thigh strain or a calf strain? I don't know why he's missed so much of the season, but they are badly missing him. And Rafinha by himself, you know, he won't be able to shoot them up the table. I do think with Leeds, though, they've got the energy in most games that I think will generate enough points for them to be okay. They're not flat. Like, I look at some teams like Watford and Burnley and Everton now, they look flat. There's no spirit there. There's no bite. There's no fight. I think at least with Leeds, even on a bad day, you know you're going to get that. My mob Arsenal beat them 4-1 just before Christmas, but they were still spirited. They were still fighting. They were still trying. They were just low on quality. I think that will ultimately see Leeds be okay. But yeah, I definitely think at the moment, I think Brentford down, I would have them all as candidates to go down.
Mm. Rafinha, Seb, he's a big transfer waiting to happen, isn't he?
Fabulous player. I watched that game against Newcastle on Saturday. And until the Newcastle goal went in, Leeds were really, really good, and they were really good around him. He has that thing where he's a very left-footed player, but even though defenders know where he's going with the ball, which side of him, them he's going to take it, they can't stop it sometimes. He's that good. So yeah, I like for me, I don't think Leeds can afford to lose him in January. I think that just because Calvin Phillips is still out, we've talked about Bamford, there are still problems in defence as well, and the lack of goals clearly is a hindrance. So they'd have to wait. I mean, to me, Leeds are an example of what happens if you have an idlog as a head coach, in that Bielsa is a wonderfully magnetic personality in many ways, and he's a very, very interesting person. At the same time, when there are things which impinge upon his ability to kind of realise his vision for how the game is, and when his sort of his reluctance to detach himself and employ a slightly more pragmatic approach during troubling months, when that's exposed, this is kind of what happens. Now, Leeds played quite well on Saturday, but I think we've seen, and Jordan mentioned the Arsenal game, I think we've seen plenty of instances where it might have been a good idea to just, right, well, we're going to play five across the back and sit in deep in this game because we might get a point. And when you have someone like Bielsa, it's just not going to happen because they don't believe in it. So that's a difficulty, but they cannot lose Rafinha. They might do in the summer. I think he's, I mean this with all due respect, but I think he's a top four player in most leagues in Europe. I think he's fabulously gifted. but you can't lose them now, just because psychologically, psychological blows. So when you see a reaction like that to a goal which feels significant in a season, you wonder sort of what else the team can take, and losing what is clearly their best player, not high on that list, I don't think that's the route to safety.
You mentioned Everton earlier, Jordan. 10 defeats in 13. Negativity is persisting there despite the injection of emotion and a bit of fear probably from Duncan Ferguson. Is this an avoidable mess?
I would say all messes are avoidable. but this one I think is tricky because a little bit like with Watford. Actually, no, not like Watford. I think Watford have a plan. It's just a bad plan. I don't think Everton even have a plan. It just seems to be, we've got lots of money. Let's invest in B-type players for lots of money, B-list players for lots of money, and appoint the manager that's the most obvious one and see where it takes us. And I think that has really infuriated the Everton fans because they see themselves as a big club. They are a big club and they think they're drifting. I was speaking to my producer a couple of weeks ago. No, actually, it was the day they lost us to Norwich. And I said to myself, is there a more downbeaten set of supporters in the Premier League than Evertonians? And what I meant by that was, if you're an Everton fan, when was the last time you had any joy watching your club? And then my producer said to me, well, yeah, but what about Newcastle and Burnley? I'm like, well, yeah, but at least those fans had a year in the Championship, where they were winning games, they lifted a trophy, there was some joy in the last few years. You're an Everton fan, when was the last Premier League season where you genuinely, you know, had joy watching your football team? I can't remember, but you're going back to probably Moyes. They had that kind of good year under Martinez, but it hasn't been good for so long. And the fans just don't know where to go because the team are spending money. Most clubs are crying out for their owners to spend money. They spend money. They just don't spend it particularly well. And where they go from here on in, I don't know. The talk of Ferguson and Rooney taking over, I think, is at first I was like, that's such a bad idea. It's nostalgia FC. However, I thought about it some more, and I think someone like Duncan Ferguson, for the remainder of the season, would inject a level of spirit and discipline into that team that I think would, in the least short term, keep them afloat. Because they are, don't get it wrong, they are in danger of going down. I don't normally buy into the whole, he's one of our own, let's bring so-and-so back to the club. But I think in this example, actually, I would appoint Ferguson for the short term. I find it interesting why, on this with the third occasion, the owners don't feel he's a viable candidate for the job long term. Now, maybe he doesn't want it long term, I don't know. But I find that interesting as well.
Can I offer a counterpoint, though? Just because, to me, I watched that game and it felt like a good thing that Everton lost that, because I think there were certain improvements in their tone of performance. I think Jordan's right. Like, I think Duncan Ferguson can be a kind of also a magnetic presence, but someone that inspires an immediate improvement. I think had Everton won that, then what happens is it encourages another short-term cycle, which is that all we need to do here is make superficial changes and change a coach and change the voices in the dressing room and change the system and the formation. Problems at Everton, some of the problems at Everton have been to do with head coaching, but all of those problems and many others are related to decisions made relating to everything at the club, which goes well beyond the dugout and the technical area. If I was an Everton fan, and this chimes with the point about enjoyment, I don't understand what my club's aim actually is. I know we've got a new stadium coming in 2025, I think, so 3 years away, but what is our guiding philosophy as a team on the pitch? What are we trying to do? Who's making decisions? What is the basis around which we recruit? I've got no idea, because you, over the summer, you appointed a new head coach and you shaped the club around him and then sacked him, sold key players to accommodate Rafa Benitez, and then he was gone. But at the same time, like Marcel Brands, who when he arrived, he was supposed to be indicative of a culture, an idea. Like Brands built a reputation in the identification and development of younger players. And yet he never seems to have had much agency at Goodison Park. That confuses me as a fan. And so what I need as a supporter to be enthusiastic and to enjoy my life as a fan is to buy into my club's vision. And Everton aren't doing that. And just sticking... I think Wayne Rooney's done actually a terrific job at Derby. I think he has far exceeded expectations. And I don't think... You know, there are still people out there looking down on him and what he's done there. I think it's kind of miraculous, actually. But nothing is going to change just by coaching appointments. It never does at a club like Everton. You have to... Unless you have a huge amount of money, which gives you financial primacy, you have to have an idea. And Everton don't. Everton have whims and changes of mind and... changes of mood, and they make decisions based on I don't know what, but it's not good, and that needs to change before anything else does.
Yeah, it's all a bit random, isn't it? You know, if you had Vitor Pereira in your managerial bingo, congratulations. He apparently is the latest manager who's about to be interviewed for the vacancy at Goodison. I think we'll learn a lot about Everton in their next league game, which is away at Newcastle. One thing that stays with me from that game on Saturday, Jordan, was the sight of Steven Gerrard at Goodison. He's got the Scouse strut down to a T, isn't he?
He really does. He really does. I think Aston Villa are the team to watch the next couple of years. I was speaking to a few people on another podcast a few weeks ago about signing of the season so far, and I put Gerrard in there because I think there's an appointment, and it's not a transfer, but as an appointment, I think that is the most significant and the best possible manager they could have got in, with someone that I think is on the rise. I think we're seeing with the Coutinho bringing in on loan, and the likes of Digne, okay, granted, he was desperate to get out of Villa. Someone that has pull, someone that is respected. I think someone we're also seeing with the tactical nous. I think Aston Villa could be the team to really watch in terms of top six over the next couple of years. I know he wants to downplay his links with Liverpool, what may happen in the future there. But the three things that I think Liverpool are going to want to see before they even look at Steven Gerrard, win a cup at Villa. I could see him doing that in the next couple of years. Have a style of play that is progressive and exciting. You go to Liverpool, you've got to do that. And the third one is, I've forgotten the third one now. Third one is, European football. That was it, sorry. So style of play, they've got to get European football, I think, 2 years in a row. And they've got to win a cup. And I think those are the three things he's got to do. And I think he can do all three of those things in the next 2 years to move on. I think if he delivers those three things in the next two seasons, I think Villa will let him go with their blessing.
Yeah, I think the key element of it, Seb, is that there's youth as well, isn't there? And the academy is beginning to produce. You know, Jacob Ramsey looks like a potential young player of the year to me. And there are suggestions around the Midlands that Carney Chukwuemeka could even be better than him.
Yeah, well, I was speaking to a Villa fan on Twitter who said that Jacob Ramsey's brother's better than him. I mean, I'd love to see the gene pool in that family, because yeah. Jacob Ramsey...
Is it a Bellingham situation with Jude and Joe?
Yeah, like I it's news to me, but I tell you what, I do know that Jacob Ramsey is a fabulous player in the making. I think what's really telling is that if you watch Villa at the moment and watch how many moves, in the last couple of games at least, have involved him, Emi Buendia and Philip Coutinho, and that little triangle of talent there, it's very telling that he fits in with that group. Like, you're talking about a guy that's moved clubs for over £100 million, Philip Coutinho, Emi Buendia, who cost north of 30, and you've got this kid who's barely two proper years of experience, who just looks fabulous. He's an England player in the making, no doubt about that. He reminds me a little bit of Adam Lallana, actually, in the sense that everything he does is so elegant and languid, and he receives the ball in all these excellent positions. He presses so well. He finishes much better. The finish that he produced at, I think it was Carrow Road against Norwich, it's just class. Take off either foot and just beat defenders off either side. He just looks a very, very good player. And I think this is part of it. So we talked about Everton and some of the issues there. I think this is what we're alluding to, the kind of the general excitement, this idea that your football club is going in the right direction. And yes, the money of Soares and Edens makes a difference, but you've got to have money in football to progress at this level. We know this. But the added layer is you have these young talents coming through, and every time you watch them, you learn a little bit, something else about them. You notice a new trait or a new ability, or you form a sort of slightly different opinion about what they might become. It's fascinating. And that goes along with kind of producing good football too. And I'd love to be a Villa fan. It'd be very, very exciting time at the moment.
If we're looking at other upwardly mobile clubs, what about Southampton, Jordan? You know, Mo Salisu was outstanding against Manchester City. In Armando Broja, you've got another Chelsea Academy product who's probably destined to build a really good career elsewhere, a bit like Livramento, his teammate at St Mary's. What's the ceiling for this sort of club, you know, given that they're under new ownership?
I think the ceiling for them would be if they can, in the next couple of years, be aiming for a top eight finish. I think eighth feels to me like, the limits of where I can't see them, you know, breaking past an Arsenal, Villa, Spurs, West Ham, Leicester. For them to surpass those teams, I just don't see that. But I think if Southampton can be on the cusp of trying to finish in a European spot and finish between seventh and, say, you know, 7th and 11th, I think that would be deemed progress for them for the next couple of seasons. One thing I find interesting is that they seem to have not been able to produce as many of the young talents that we saw come through, or their scouting system isn't as particularly as good as it was, you know, maybe 5 or 6 years ago when they had all those players that Liverpool, you know, mainly picked off one by one. So I think they need to kind of really reinvest in doing that again. If they're going to go big and spend with these new owners, then I think Villa is the model to see, where you can get a mixture of producing your own young talent whilst really making a mark in the European transfer market too. But I think if they can identify, like I said, finishing in that kind of 8th to 10th or 11th kind of standing and a cup run, teams like Southampton for me are never going to finish in the top 4 or top 6, but they can win an FA Cup, they can win a League Cup, and I think that maybe is where Southampton, their focus for the next couple of seasons should be, in my view.
Let's look at the scramble for 4th, Seb. Manchester United, now they hold that position at the moment. Frankly, they baffle me. They continue to dig out these unlikely wins after really failing to impress. At what point does that become a strength rather than a sign of weakness?
Good question. It's the old adage, isn't it, about winning when you play badly. I felt Saturday's win was a little bit more about West Ham not really having enough strength and depth and having too narrow a core of players, but late winners are late winners. Also, seeing Marcus Rashford score, given the last few months that he's had, really positive development. I think at the moment why it matters is for Ralph Rangnick, Ralph Rangnick's ideology is not going to bed in within 3 months. It's just not going to happen. He's someone that he wants to be an architect of a club, not somebody who sets up a team in a particular formation and gets them to play in a certain way. That is the product of work he does, the bigger overarching work that he does generally. So why it matters is, well, the more games they win, the more credibility he has, the more agency he might have in whatever this consultancy role he acquires in the summer it becomes. Also, it's imperative that Manchester United are playing Champions League football. Just is. It's humiliation might be a too strong word, but it is at least a little bit silly to see a club like that playing anywhere other than the Champions League, given the resources at their disposal. It's just nonsense for them to underperform to that level. And also from a recruiting standpoint, the way forward is lit by being able to provide Champions League football to players. It always has been, and it always will be. But Rangnick, I think, win games, be able to point to a position higher up the table, and all of a sudden, yeah, it's that word, it's credibility. And it's very, very important. Man United just need to win games at the moment.
Can I just briefly add to the Marcus Rashford mention that Seb there with the goal he got late on? I think it was one thing I noticed about Rashford was it was the first time in, I think, maybe a year and a half, I saw him smile. And I think someone like Rashford is at his best when he's happy and he's smiling. Even if he's not necessarily playing well, he's still, you know, got a smile on his face. He smiled. And I think I'm a bit uncomfortable with this kind of narrative that all the work he's doing off the field is significantly impacting his performances on the field. Whilst I agree, he's paid to do a job and you've got to do that job. I totally understand that. If I was a United fan, I want to see Marcus Rashford perform on the pitch. But I don't like this conflation of the stuff that he's doing off the field is the reason. Mm. And he's got to stop that because he's got to get back to football. It kind of is akin to the old American, just shut up and dribble, which I'm not comfortable with as well. So I was really glad. I hated it as an Arsenal fan. Absolutely hated it. It was a kick in the gut. But as a Marcus Rashford fan, I love just seeing him smile. It was really nice.
Didn't go down well with too many West Ham fans either, to be honest. And we are in an age where the come and get me plea is becoming even more subtle. If you're that West Ham fan, Seb, are you concerned by Declan Rice's pretty flattering comments about playing at Old Trafford?
No, because I think you have to accept it. Like, this is life for clubs who are not Manchester United, Manchester City and Chelsea. It's just the way it is. And Liverpool, I suspect. Like, there was a Mazraoui, the Ajax fullback / wingback over the weekend. He was talking about his contractual situation. He was very, very transparent. He said, like, you know, if I'm not renewing my contract, then it generally means one thing. And I'm a big fan of players being kind of straightforward and not patronising fans or not sort of leading them down the garden path. And Declan Rice, if West Ham can get in the Champions League, then maybe Declan Rice stays at West Ham. If they don't, he's going to be enticed to a club that can offer that kind of football. And this has been a reality of the game for a very long time. Everton fans will know that. Tottenham fans will know that. For a while, Liverpool fans knew that. You know, it's the way it is. And I don't see him as someone that will abandon ship in the middle of the season. So there's comfort in that. And also, West Ham will get a massive fee for Declan Rice. Like, you're talking about a very good player. You're talking about a very, very good English player, which comes with the kind of the usual taxes. And so it's disappointing because it would be disappointing. But at the same time, like, there is an advantage to be taken from the development of this fabulous player. It's a player they didn't pay a fee for. So it will be 60, 70, 80 million pounds worth of pure profit. And for a club like West Ham, it's been a long time since you've seen like that kind of sale happen, really.
Yeah, but when you look at it, I'm going to try and bring things a bit together now, chaps. I want to look at your respective clubs or the clubs with which you're associated. You'll go first, Jordan. Arsenal. Do they need to pay the asking price for Vlahovic? They certainly need a striker, don't they? And with Aubameyang, you know, there's suggestions of more indiscipline at AFCON. Do they just need to get him out of the building as soon as?
So the first question with Vlahovic, I think Arsenal need to be very careful. The reported fee that's going to be required to get Vlahovic in this window, I'm seeing is like 68 million. Now, spending that sort of money in January, you've got to be really, really sure that he's the guy you want. He's the guy that fits into how you're trying to play for the next couple of years. You've also got to be very, very sure that Mikel Arteta is going to be there next season. Because one thing that I think no one's talking about is the fact that it's so tight between United, Spurs, Arsenal, West Ham, and now even Wolves. One of those teams is going to finish eighth. It could be United, it could be Arsenal. They're going to finish eighth. It's going to be so close. If Mikel Arteta doesn't finish in the top six, Mike, you know me, I'm Team Arteta. But if he doesn't get at the bare minimum top six, I don't see how he can continue in his job. And if you're going to outlay that amount of money on a striker in January, you've got to know that he's fitting into a plan for the next 2 or 3 years. So I think they've got to be very careful a bit with that signing. And I know they've got, there's a lot of strikers, Aubameyang, Lacazette and Eddie Nketiah, running down their contracts. They're going to go for free in the summer. So I get the kind of need for panic, but Arsenal can't afford to panic. What they don't want to be doing is left with a striker in a year's time, Vlahovic, on a massive contract who doesn't fit the style of play of the new manager potentially. So yes, Arsenal need a striker ASAP. But I think they need to go for this Vlahovic guy if they think he's the guy that's going to propel them for the next 2 or 3 years. Not just, we need a guy now. Regarding Aubameyang, listen, I was very, very supportive of Arteta's stance in disciplining him. One of the big things at Arsenal in the last 5 or 6 years, maybe more, is it's a culture at Arsenal needs to be changed. He's trying to address that culture of more discipline, accountability, as Seb used that word earlier on as well. And he's done that with Aubameyang. Now, you're in a position whereby, okay, how long are you going to continuously punish Aubameyang? I've heard conflicting reports about Aubameyang's conduct in Africa at the AFCON. I've heard from some journalists out there that actually it's been massively blown up, what he's been doing out there. I've heard from other journalists that actually he's been a disgrace and he's been an embarrassment out there. So I can't really comment on terms of his conduct out there. But from an Arsenal perspective, I think Mikel Arteta now has to really find his man management skills and find a way to reintegrate Aubameyang back into the team, even if it is just for 6 more months. Because yes, Arsenal need a forward. And yes, I think that he was right to punish Aubameyang, but he can't cut off his nose to spite his face, and he needs a striker, and Aubameyang is there. Try and find a way to reintegrate him and use him again.
It's a little bit similar with Spurs, is it, Seb? In as much as that their season's probably about to be shaped, and maybe even their short-term future, being shaped by this struggle for the purse strings, which always seems to happen at Spurs, doesn't it? You know, they need creativity. They need some balance in midfield. Looks like Conte's already made his mind up on Dele and Ndombele and also Lo Celso. What's going to happen, do you think, at your club in the next couple of weeks or next week or so? And will that influence Conte's long-term future with them?
I don't know what will happen, but I know definitively it will shape his long-term future. If Conte doesn't get what he wants, then we know what he does. Spurs need to have a bit of a think about this, because I think they need to be appreciative of the fact that they're very, very lucky to be able to have appointed Antonio Conte in the first place. There aren't many teams who have their squad and who are in their position that get to appoint a manager like that. And they also want to appreciate what life looks like should he walk out on them. I don't think you're going to appoint a superstar coach. You're not going to appoint one of the sort of the great minds of European football. You're back to your Nuno Espirito Santo shelf. What needs to happen? I don't know what will happen. What needs to happen? Ndombele needs to go. Lo Celso needs to go. Unfortunately, I love Dele Alli. I've got a lot of time for him as a player and as a person. He needs a new club just because he needs a fresh start. He needs to stop sort of chasing his past a little bit at Tottenham. And also, I don't think the system works for him, really. So he needs to go somewhere where he feels comfortable. And you need to spend some money. It's just, there can be no excuses. There's always an excuse with Tottenham, isn't there? There's always a kind of, yeah, but it's uniquely difficult for us because of this. And you can't sign a player to support Harry Kane because no one wants to be his backup. And you can't sign a midfielder because, oh, I don't know. And, you know, can't get this player because XYZ is always an excuse. So this time, if you want Antonio Conte to stay and if you want Antonio Conte to deliver, need another defender, another wing back, another midfielder, and you need someone to support Kane. You can't do it on the cheap. Can't do it. And fundamentally, I think it's very telling that over the last 5 days, Spurs went from the euphoria of that win at Leicester, which was wonderful. You know, I'm dancing around my living room trying not to kind of antagonize my cats. Like, my wife's teaching me the virtue of celebrating silently, which I feel like I'm hemorrhaging when I do that. trying to bite back on my enthusiasm. To what I saw at Stamford Bridge, which it was just rubbish. And I don't blame the coach. I just think he's doing what he can. He's like a chef with limited ingredients. It's just players in positions just aren't good enough. There's no tact glance. There's no analysis. It's just you over there, you over there, you over there. You're not good enough to be playing at this level. You can never win this kind of game. And everyone knows it. And so you have to show the same care and consideration to the first team as Spurs always seem to with the stadium or the NFL deal or whatever else they're doing. Like, it's, as a Spurs fan, it's very disheartening because it feels like the team is the least important thing there. And it really does, you know, ebb away at your enthusiasm for this. And it would do to Conte. If Conte left Tottenham now, he'd have another job by tea time. Spurs need to think about that. Really, really, they do.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, and please shout if you disagree with me, chaps, it looks to me the top three are settled, actually. City, Liverpool, Chelsea. Given that, just want to end very briefly looking at VAR. I know it's tiresome, but Patrick Vieira yesterday, Jordan, was he right to complain about big club bias?
Yes, in a word. I think there has been and always, unfortunately, will be big club bias. Referees will deny that. The officials will say no. And they will also be offended by the idea that their professionalism is swayed based on who they're refereeing. But I think there's an element of human nature. That, you know, you walk into a club and the prettiest girl's going to get the attention. It's not necessarily that the girl over there isn't most intelligent or the most talented, but the pretty girl gets, it's just the way the brain is wired, it's going to go to the most attractive woman in the club. And I think when referees are at Old Trafford and they're at the Emirates and they're at Etihad and Anfield, or even at smaller grounds where there's a big team playing, I think there is that inherent natural leaning towards the benefit of the doubt or decisions that go with the big club. So I think he was right. I think the bigger issue is I don't think you're ever going to change that. I don't think that's just one of the unfortunate things about football, that big clubs, big personalities generally get favoured more so than everybody else.
Given that, West Ham fans were unhappy with what went on in the build-up to the goal at Old Trafford. What about the standard of refereeing? Has it, there's a common consent. It's pretty low at the moment. And is that being compounded by the supposed certainties of VAR, do you think?
No, I think it goes a little bit higher than that. I would point my finger at the PGMOL and the kind of the way that, careful how I phrase this, but the manner in which they kind of argue their way around mistakes. And again, it's like the fifth time we've talked about it, accountability. There was that period of time about a year ago, 2 years ago, when there were kind of anomalies in the rules and mistakes made and incorrect uses of VAR. And there's always a reason why the PGMOL are not wrong. Always a reason. Even if it's kind of like we're going to kind of change the interpretation of the rules in midweek so that we don't have to admit a mistake. And I think that's part of the problem. I think it's a culture of, never admitting mistakes, always finding a way to explain why actually, right decisions were made. And I think that comes from the very, very top. Very, very top. And VAR, it is what it is. It infuriates me. I hate it as much as everybody else. And I think there is a little bit of performative outrage about it now. Like, I think every VAR decision is now treated as the worst thing that has ever happened. And I don't really buy that. I find its interruption into games worse than the decisions it makes. Like that Liverpool penalty, give it or don't give it, but don't take 15 replays in 5 minutes to make up your mind.
Exactly.
I don't have a problem with it either way, but just quickly. It's a sport. It's not maths at school with like protractors and and drawing lines on screen. I it's a sport. It's entertainment. It's my release from all that stuff. So don't ruin it. But I don't know. I think I don't know about refereeing standards, but I think culture around refereeing is not in a good place. Put it that way.
Yeah, well, I'd agree with that. I think VAR remains a bureaucratic monstrosity. I think if you can't reach
say
a decision,
I feel, Mike.
Well, you've got to do it. If you can't reach a decision inside, say, 30 seconds, it's got to go with the on-field referee, regardless of the risk of human error. Because human error is part of life. The problem is, I think, the standard of refereeing has never been lower, but decisions are being reached without football logic or a feel for the game. They're hidden from the crowd and from TV's millions, by the way. Now, there's no shame in making a mistake, but the errors will continue until Mike Riley is put out to pasture. His old pals act's gone on far too long. Now, do you agree? Please let me know either way. In the meantime, thanks to Jordan and Seb for their insight, and thank you for listening to the Football Writers Podcast.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term medical plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.